What is toxic shame? Could it be a root cause of escalating numbers of addictions, mood disorders, compulsions, and violent acts? Well, our guest today is going to talk about this in talking about his book, The Science of Shame and Its Treatment. Dr. Gerald Fishkin is our author guest today. He has years of clinical practice and extensive research providing the background for his new release. Dr. Fishkin earned his PhD in clinical psychology and has been in private practice since 1970. He has authored three other books, including American Dream, American Burnout, How to Cope When It All Gets to Be Too Much, Police Burnout, and Firefighter and Paramedic Burnout. He's an expert in clinical and forensic hypnosis. He has worked with witnesses of violent crimes and scene reconstruction, as well as aided in suspect identification. According to a recent Columbia University study, the number of nicotine, alcohol, and other drug-related Americans has surpassed those with heart disease, cancer, or diabetes. Negative self-talk and unrelenting self-abuse, shame, contribute to dangerous illness, while many of those behaviors have a wide-reaching impact on our culture and economy. Dr. Fishkin's science-based approach for getting to the true cause of addictions and compulsive disorders offers frontline solutions to this significant public health danger. I'm sure that, as you know from listening to this program for many years, I probably have a somewhat different take on the cause and treatment of addiction. But we're going to have Dr. Fishkin on today, and he's going to tell you about what he thinks about this horrible disease. Jerry, it's nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you so much, Wynn, for having me. It's a pleasure to be able to talk with you today and to your audience about something that is truly important to me.
I think addiction is the worst disease that there is, because how it affects so many people. And what's your take on that?
Well, Wynn, I have multiple takes on it. I think that addictions affect our sense of self. And we're going to talk about toxic shame and all of that. But I think that because addictions affect the self, and we only have one self, it is the most devastating problem that faces or confronts humanity today. And I think it's worse than cancer. I think it's worse than any traumatic event that can befall a person, because it is unrelenting and toxic, and it keeps an individual down, never lets them rise up to become the best version of themselves they can be.
Absolutely. Now, I previously talked about the Columbia University study on substances, but that's only part of the addictive problem. We have everything from negative thinking to overeating to sexual abuse, and the list goes on and on and on. And so today we're going to try to hit into some of this and see where we can get. First off, your book is called The Science of Shame. You talk about toxic shame. Can you define toxic shame for me?
Well, sure, but I think in order to define toxic shame, we have to talk about shame and what is shame. And my book is the first to really define shame as a neurocortical process. In other words, shame lives in the brain. And my research shows that shame resides in the basal ganglia of the brain, just above the limbic system. Now, what does that mean? We all have shame. Shame is a good thing in many respects. It keeps us on the straight and narrow. And it keeps us socially appropriate. So we all have shame, and I think one of the goals in life is to keep our shame in order, in line, so that we are good social citizens. Toxic shame, on the other hand, in my view, is the result of early life abuse, trauma, neglect, violence, And what it really means is that a child's sense of self, what we just talked about, is severely damaged due to a broken bond or broken bonding experiences. A child with toxic shame never learns how to self-soothe. So when I talk about toxic shame, I'm talking about individuals who never had a healthy bonding experience or who grew up in a violent, toxic, exposed place, like in the ghettos and like in war-torn areas. Many of these individuals develop this sense of this reduced sense of self. And they, because oxytocin, that bonding chemical, isn't present in many of these individuals in early life, they never learn to self-soothe. And they try to get that sense of warmth and comfort, that sense of soothing, from other chemicals. And that is where I talk about the addictions. Also affects mood, and we have the mood disorders. So toxic shame is regular shame on steroids, if you will.
Okay. Now, I call guilt and shame two of the very large number of symptoms of the disease of addiction. Tell me about the difference between guilt and shame.
Oh, thank you. That's a good one. And I hope that your viewing audience never uses the words guilt and shame coterminously or together, because guilt and shame are not the same. As I said, shame is about the self, and it resides in that part of the basal part, the very lowest part of the brain, the early brain, if you will. But guilt is basically an infraction of a value, a learned value. So guilt is more of a thought-related effect, if you will, or emotion, where shame is an affect. So when a child steals a candy bar and he knows that stealing is bad, or does something that infracts something that he's learned, he's going to feel maybe a sense of anxiety because he doesn't want to get caught, or if there's a penalty for doing something wrong. And that's guilt. We all know about that. Now, some people are born without the ability to feel guilt because we call them sociopaths or antisocial personalities. But for the most part, and for most of us, if we do something wrong or break a value, a learned value, we're going to experience guilt. Shame, on the other hand, is always about the self. So guilt is about something we've done and the fear of punishment or reprisal. Shame is always about who we are, our sense of self and self-worth. So when we have a shame attack, we feel like we want to disappear. We want to become invalid. We want to become invisible because it is painful. It's about our sense of self. Whereas with guilt, we have a sense of anxiety and that. And hopefully we won't, do it again. We won't do a bad thing again. So there is a fundamental and primary difference. It's not only a social difference, but it's a neurological difference as well.
Okay. You talk about low sense of self. I talk about low self-esteem.
Yes.
I think we're talking about the same thing.
When we're talking exactly about the same thing.
And I have found that low self-esteem is the primary cause of all the addictions, and you're going to tell us how shame or toxic shame, which contributes to low self-esteem, can be treated.
Right, in terms of how we deal with it. But I'd like to just, if I could, go into what our basic fears are, because I think that this is really associated with that sense of self, and then I can talk about the treatment. But really, there are great fears that most people have. And I think fear of being abandoned, not being good enough, going crazy, losing a relationship, being a failure, emptiness, displeasing someone, and the list goes on and on. And I think many people will drink or drug or do something behind those fears. They never learn to self-soothe. And so the goal of treatment is really to help develop a sense of self-worth and self-compassion. Because I think self-compassion, which is another affect, shame is one affect, compassion is another. I think that developing in treatment a sense of self-compassion is a key to getting past the addictive process or a mood process.
Okay. So tell me, what kind of research are you familiar with that makes shame one of the larger causes of addiction?
Well, I think there's a ton of research, and I have it all laid out in my book, The Science of Shame and Its Treatment, and I don't know necessarily to go into all of it, but I can tell you that Antonio Damasio, Dr. Antonio Damasio, and his team of neuroscientists at USC, they've written two books on the sense of self or consciousness, where they have actually neurologically proven that shame resides in this a certain area of the brain through their research. So I don't think it's necessary for me to go through that. It's really laid out quite well in my book for your readers.
Okay.
The book is really based upon a lot of that kind of empirical research.
Okay.
What I have found most important when, and I've been in clinical practice since 1970, as you said, so that's 46 years. Every time I have worked with someone with cognitive behavioral therapy, and we get to a certain treatment place where they're about to talk about their wound, or I begin to uncover an early life wound, per se, many of these individuals bolt from treatment, especially with cognitive behavioral therapy. It's more of a research-based approach, but it is not a warm approach. It is not a compassionate-based approach to treatment. So what happened, how I got into this, was I started to see that I was losing patient after patient through the use of cognitive behavioral therapy, and especially when it came to uncovering those early wounds. Many of these individuals didn't even remember what the wounds were. Some could identify a toxic parent or a toxic relationship, but the wounds itself and how they perceived the wounds many times were hidden or covered up so deeply that the patient could not tolerate it. And for some, the first time they ever talk about it, if they ever did, was in treatment. And then because you try to, especially with cognitive behavioral therapy, try to get them to deal with it cognitively, they typically can't, because it's not a cognitive experience. It's an affective one. It runs very deep in their emotional system.
Okay, Jerry. Well, we have a lot of listeners today that have heard the words cognitive therapy, but they don't have any idea what it is. Can you bring that down to an eighth grade level and tell our listeners?
Definitely. I would love to. Basically, cognitive behavioral therapy says that there's an activating event, and then there is a belief system about that event, and then there is a corresponding cognition, and then a behavior. You know, we can't, with wounds that are so deep in the psyche from trauma, early life trauma or neglect or abuse, abandonment, cognitive behavioral therapy basically says if you change the way you think about it, it's going to get better. It's just absolutely and fundamentally ludicrous, because it doesn't affect the wound. It doesn't allow the patient to get in touch with that basic core pain, that hurt, that deep hurt. Oftentimes, I'll have patients write letters if it's a parent that abused the patient or some adult in the early life relationship of that my patient. I'll have them write a letter. I'll have them deal with it through some kind of an active process where they can discharge those emotions that have been covered for years. Cognitive behavioral therapy says we want to change how you think about it. And compassion-based therapy says, I want you to be able to get the feelings out so that you can begin to rebuild your sense of self and you can uncover the wound and basically understand that it's not your fault. You didn't do this. You know, and maybe some of your listeners have seen the movie Good Will Hunting, and there's a scene where Robin Williams puts his arms around Matt Damon. I don't know if you saw the movie, where he says to Matt Damon, who was struggling with something so basic and terrible in his life, he says, "It's not your fault." And that scene, I could hear people crying in the theater when I was there listening, watching the movie. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. But for so many children or adults who had these toxic early life experiences, they believe that they brought it on, whatever it was. They believe that it's their fault that their parents abandoned them, or it's their fault that they were put in the system, or it's their fault that they were sexually abused or violated in some horrible way. But that's not the issue. That's not true. And with compassion-based treatment, we can help that individual understand that they were victims as children. We don't like to use the word victim in treatment, but by all accounts, and in my work today, I truly see that many of these individuals were victims. You know, children come into this world as a tabula rasa, a blank slate. I really believe that. And I think what's written upon that slate affects children, affects all of us for the rest of our life. And if we can get to those early wounds and discuss them and how they feel about it and all of that, we can begin the process of change. I have, you know, in the last 47 years of, or 46 years of working with these folks, I find that when we're able to develop a healthy relationship, because I think therapy is relationship bound, I think that the best causes results in treatment come when we're not playing doctor, but when we're being a person with somebody else and allowing them to reveal who they are and their biggest fears. You know, I read that list of the biggest fears, but people on toxic shame, those fears are on steroids when they have this exaggerated sense that they're just broken, that they're not good enough. And how many times in treatment do we hear a patient say, I'm not good enough? They think they have to be perfect. And I think that the goal of treatment is to help all of us understand that we're perfectly imperfect. We're not perfect. We do the best we can.
Well, Jerry, we both agree that low self-esteem or low sense of self is the underlying problem in addictions. Now, you've been talking about how this relates from earlier things that happen to people in their life.
Right.
And I have found that it doesn't really make any difference where a person comes from, what kind of background they have. Sure, some of them have terrible backgrounds and cause this low self-esteem, but some of them did not. And I get the same results regardless of where the person comes from. So my take on it is, if I can somehow or the other increase the person's low self-esteem, then he won't need the addiction. Is that anywhere compatible with your thinking?
Absolutely. It's 100%. But what I find first is that when we're dealing with if we're just dealing with chemical addictions rather than the mood disorders, because they're part of it as well, they're part of the process, we'll get the person through recovery. I don't think we can really do treatment with anybody while they're practicing their addiction. I think that a person has to go through the detoxification period or process. We have to get them kind of clean and sober in order for them to get rational. Because I think what happens is, for many of these people, there's what we call limbic hijacking. That is, the limbic system is in the old part of the brain where shame lives. And I think that oftentimes, because this low self-esteem hijacks an individual and takes them into a place of defensiveness, we can get a person off of the drugs, off of the alcohol, get them sober, then we can really begin the process of dealing with who they are and how they are and their self-perception and begin dealing with that wound. As you know, we're both talking about the same thing, that is self-esteem or self-worth. But it's really all about that sense of self. And indeed, Damasio and his team at SC have talked about that sense of self is also a neurological place. It's in the central medial nucleus of the brain. It's in the middle of the brain. So sense of self really derives not only from our life experience, but it's also a neurological process. And we know that when we put somebody under general anesthesia, you're a doctor, you know that when they're still alive, but they have no sense of self, they have no sense of that autobiographical self. So sense of self is not only a cognitive thing and a perceptual thing, but it is or an awareness thing, but it's also a neurologically based process. And when we can get somebody clean and sober and get their brain, their clean brain functioning in a healthy, respectable way, then we can really begin the process of treatment. I find that for many of my patients, I have to get them, especially those that come in, and the young ones especially, who have been drinking or drugging for a long period of time, you want them to get off the drugs and alcohol so they can begin to deal with and develop calluses about the self. You know what I mean? Calluses. They have to live in the world, and they have to be able to understand in a clean and sober way, perceptually, who they are and how they are, so that we can work with their fears and their defenses and all of that to get them through this process to build a healthy sense of self-worth and good self-esteem. So yeah, I think we're both saying exactly the same thing. I'm just looking at it from a different point of view, from a neuroscience point of view, because it makes more sense to me to be able to pinpoint where these areas are in the brain and how they affect us and what we need to do to make it a better world.
The Science of Shame and Its Treatment. This is a book that we're discussing today by Dr. Gerald Fishkin. Gerald, how do they get a copy of your book?
Well, they can go to my website, which is drgeraldfishkin.com. That's Dr. GeraldFishkin.com. Or they can go to Amazon. Amazon just received the books, and they're shipping now. Or they can go to my publisher direct, and that's an 800 number. And that number, Wynn, is 621-2736. Again, 800-621-2736.
Great. Okay, so you had talked about compassion therapy, and I don't know what you were talking about. Can you help me out there?
Oh, absolutely. What we're finding is that compassion-based therapies have to do with helping the individual develop a sense of self-compassion. And what is compassion? I break it down in my book as two things, empathy and attunement. We have to have empathy, and empathy is kind of a semi-cognitive process where we can understand another, okay? And attunement means that we're attuned, we're in tune, we can see what's going on with that other person. Well, those two processes in treatment mean that we can help a person become attuned to themselves. That means like themselves. We can help a person have compassion and empathy so that they can begin to feel things. And that's the whole part of overcoming addictions, is to be able to feel things, good and bad, in a healthy way, without causing one to think that they're just broken or they're terrible or not good enough. So while cognitive behavioral therapy does not work in the early parts of treatment, we can, in the later parts of treatment, help an individual overcome their toxic thoughts as well as get in touch with who they are compassionately. And compassion-based therapy means that the therapist isn't doing something to the patient. They're actually in the moment with a patient. I think in my early training, back in the late 60s and early 70s, I found that when we're with a patient, who they are in their moment of sadness, and they can open up and reveal themselves, that is the beginning of change. Most of the time, people come into treatment and they're all armored up. They're all defensed up, and they, you know, you can't break through. Their defenses are like Fort Knox. And it's almost impossible to get through to them. But if we're acting as if not a doctor, but a person with them in treatment, almost as confessional, I think, freedom to express who they are in a non-judgmental way is the beginning of change, I believe.
Okay. Gerald, we're down to our last minute. I want you to tell us what your mission or purpose in life is in, let's say, 30 seconds.
Thank you. I can do that. This comes from an idea that Mark Twain had, and I'd like to quote Mark Twain. He said, "The fear of death follows the fear of life. A man who lives fully is is prepared to die at any time." Now, certainly, that's the end quote. But I really think that when we live a full life, when we are able to really extend ourselves and enjoy the moments of our life and our experience on earth, not only with other people, but especially with ourselves, that we are living life in the most full and healthy way we can. And that is my goal in treatment, always. Oh. And any way I can get to that is meaningful and important to me.
Right. Gerald Fishkin, The Science of Shame. Go out and get a copy. It's a good book. Thanks, Gerald.
Wynn, this was a wonderful talk. Thank you so much for having me.